Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. Welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, how are the presidential campaigns marketing to Latinos?
And Arizona's not the only state in which reservoirs are seeing lower water levels.
But first, Election Day is less than a week away. But voters in Arizona have been turning in ballots since the beginning of October. And so far, total returns add up to nearly 2 million votes. That's according to a database created by Democratic strategist Sam Almy with Uplift Strategies. Each election cycle, he tracks early ballots by party, by age, by gender, and more. And he's on the line now to talk more about it. Good morning there, Sam.
Hi, Lauren. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming on. Okay, so let's start with the big picture numbers here. Right now, we've got about 1.8 million ballots tracked on your database. How does this look in terms of turnout compared to years past?
That's great. I updated right before I came on, and we're over that 2 million mark right now.
Oh, wow. It went fast.
Yes. Yeah. Maricopa had a big file today. Turnout is now at 46.4% statewide. And that looks really in line. It's actually ahead of where we were in 2016, but a little bit behind where we were in 2020, where, of course, everybody was voting by mail.
Interesting. Okay, so let's break this down by party. You also track turnout rates by party. Where do each of them stand at this point?
Right now, Democrats and Republicans are tied in overall turnout at 53.3%. And then independents and other third parties are coming in at 33.8%.
Okay. So even if they are tied right now in terms of turnout, like, you know, the number of voters within each party that are voting early, Republicans have a big voter registration advantage in our state that's gotten even bigger, it sounds like.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the story of this election. In both 2016 and 2020, Republicans had about a 150,000 voter advantage, registered voter. Right now, it's double that, closer to 300,000. And as a result, their ballot advantage over Democrats is they've returned 155,000 more ballots than Democrats.
Okay, so in your opinion, how could Dems pull out a win in Arizona? How did they do it in 2020?
Well, I think in 2020, our big success was voting by mail. Mm. But what we're seeing now is sort of a back to more traditional pre-pandemic voting patterns, where we're going to see an electorate more similar to 2016. So Democrats are really going to rely on lots of poll voters and early ballot drop-offs, which is a success we saw in 2018.
Okay. So if we're looking toward Election Day, we've already seen a little more than half of voters for each party already vote, right? Turnout's looking pretty high, 46% overall. What does this mean for how long lines might be, what overall turnout we're expecting?
For overall turnout, I did a little napkin math yesterday, and I got about 75%. I think earlier this year, I was looking at 77%. So I think that's going to be my range as my turnout estimate. As for lines at the polls, we may see a little hiccups here and there, probably at the start of elections. But with so many counties, Maricopa and Pima in particular, adopting this vote center model, mm-hmm. we're going to have a lot fewer problems at the polls with ID, you went to the wrong location, and a lot fewer provisional ballots because of these vote centers that we have.
Okay. So let's narrow in on some of the demographic trends that you're watching here as these early ballots come in. Politicos are always saying that young voters don't turn out. What are we seeing on that front so far?
Well, it's like that. Arizona, like many Sun Belt states, the older voters are definitely voting in force. That's something we typically see. Right now, baby boomers, that generation makes up 42% of all returns. If you're looking at millennials and Gen Z, they make up about 23% of returns.
Okay.
That being said, 2 weeks ago, boomers were 54% of the vote, and millennials and Gen Z were 12%. So it does get younger. And I do expect it to continue that trend to get younger as we approach Election Day.
Okay, more young voters voting now. Okay, the big story that many are predicting nationally, at least, that will come out of this election is the gender gap, right? The majority of women say they'll vote for Harris in these national polls. The majority of men say they'll vote for Trump. But women traditionally vote in higher numbers. Is that holding true in what you're seeing so far in these early numbers in Arizona?
Yeah, that's something that's held true for a number of years in Arizona. Right now, women are turning out at 46%, men at 44%, but women have returned almost 120,000 more ballots around the state.
Wow. Okay. So let's zoom in before I let you go on a few of the competitive districts we're watching this election cycle in terms of congressional races for a moment. In CD1, we have a close race between Democrat Amish Shah and incumbent Republican David Schweikert. What's turnout looking like there and how might that affect the race?
Sure. So turnout is right now it's at 56.6%. So a little bit higher than statewide. You expect that in a competitive district. It is a higher turnout district. Compared to 2020, they're actually ahead of where they were by a couple points in turnout. Mm. When we look at the Democrat to Republican ballot advantage, Republicans have a return advantage of about 30,000 ballots right now.
Okay. Let's turn quickly then in the last minute here to Southern Arizona CD6, where we have a tight predicted race between Democratic challenger Kirsten Engel and Republican Juan Ciscomani. What's turnout looking like there?
Another high turnout race. Right now, they're at 50.1% in overall turnout. This, like you mentioned, this race is close. Democrats have the slightest ballot advantage of 640 right now.
All right, 640, very close. And of course, changing all the time. That is Democratic strategist Sam Almy joining us from Uplift Strategies. Sam, thank you so much for coming on. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Lauren.
Researchers at ASU are trying to get a sense of how 18 to 30-year-olds in this country perceive their status and identity as Americans. The Arizona Youth Identity Project is asking questions in separate waves and has found some interesting things, especially when it comes to how this population thinks about the American flag. Chris Vera Phillips is a PhD candidate and faculty associate at ASU's Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication. She joins me to talk more about this. And Chris, what were you hoping to find out first off with these questions?
Ultimately, our big research group, we were interested in the ways that Arizona youth, how they identify and their perspectives on, you know, generally life, especially in the face of like changing economic conditions, political conditions, and just everything happens to be very fluid for them. So with that perspective, that's how we went into this idea of doing multiple waves of interviews with our participants and then eventually getting to the mixed methods part where we did surveys as well as the photo voice methods.
So how did you go about trying to sort of gauge these things with them? Like, what kinds of things did you ask them? And, you know, how did you try to draw some of the stuff out?
Sure. We did have a, just an interview guide. And basically, we were asking them questions like, what does it mean to be American to you? What does it mean to feel American? And also, what does it mean to act American? And especially since they were answering not just in these interview conversations that we have, but also through the folks who agreed to do the photo voice part, they were also responding with images, photos that they've taken, as well as images and graphics they found online to be able to respond.
And it sounds like a lot of those images that you got back included, in some capacity, the American flag.
Yes. And that was actually really exciting for us because we didn't mention American flag anywhere in the questions. This all came really organically out of our participants. So when, you know, the idea of like, what does it mean to be American and feel American? They submitted pictures, more than 140 some pictures of the flag. And then also there were iterations of the flag, especially since I think people are really used to, tech savvy sometimes when it comes to finding images. They can find an image that exactly means, okay, that's what I mean about the flag, modifications of the flag, the flag in different contexts and what have you. And so that's what we found.
How many different contexts were there? Like, were there different kinds of contexts in which people were using the flags that were maybe at odds with each other?
potentially at odds. I think odds is the right word. I would say differing opinions, mm-hmm. you know, to be just a little more accepting. And what it comes down to, I think, when people presented the flag as something that what it means to be American, and I think that's within the context of who they are and where they come from, and also what's happening in society. So for some people, there's the traditional idea of the flag, whether it's a flag and their family member who has served our country in war and in the military service. There might be some folks who see the flag as a unifying symbol, again, coming back to that idea of American citizenship and patriotism. But there's also something that also emerged, especially, again, going back to the flag being used as a symbol that you see a lot at Trump rallies, for example, MAGA rallies and what have you. So the, what we also uncovered from our data was that there was this idea of a symbolic appropriation of the flag that wasn't necessarily unifying, but also othering. And we did this isn't the first time we've seen it before. If you go back to the 9/11 attacks, right, especially people who don't outwardly look American, they use the flag as a sign of defense, saying that I'm on your team too. But then eventually, when we went through our wave of interviews, it happened. We did a round of interviews just after President Biden's 100 days in office, and within that time frame, when we were asking people about the flag, folks who felt the flag was othering and also being a divisive symbol, came to see that, you know what, maybe it's not so much that way anymore.
Did you find anything about flags other than the American flag? Because there's been so much discussion about other flags, either throughout history or newer flags that have, you know, become popular over the years, having either very specific meanings or maybe meanings that are a little bit different than what their original ones were.
Sure. What we did, just looking up some of our flags, not necessarily official flags per se, but because we do have a high our sample, again, were white participants, Latino-Latino-X participants, and indigenous communities. We did have modifications of the flag that it would also involve, for example, the Mexican flag. And I think that's just a way of people being able to say that not only are we a part of this country, that we live here, that we work here, we love here, we may die here, but at the same time, there's other parts of your identity that is not just red, white, and blue.
What were some of the other non-flag images that you got? Like, I'm curious what other sort of symbols or images people thought said American or made them feel American.
Definitely the colors. Some people went with colors and symbols. So like one this was a Native American woman from Flagstaff, wore red, white, and blue on their shirt, plus their little scrunchie and in their rings. And then she said in her caption, "Today we want to ask you what it means to be American." So that was the prompt. And then she wrote, "Celebrating 4th of July because I'm showing it externally." So there's this idea where we come from, you know, the way we show our identity, whether it's in colors or the flag, it comes back to this theoretical grounding of collective effervescence. And so, again, you see that a lot in religious symbols, for example, whether it's the cross or what have you, or sporting events wearing those colors. And it brings people together, whether they're, you know, strangers or they have some their shared common ground. It could be expressed in these symbols.
So what to you is the takeaway from this? Like, what do you think it all means?
I think for me, what is really exciting about this is that we have a way to be able to articulate what we consider as identity, representation, and what we consider as normal. And again, the really cool thing is, like, there's no, like, one definition that's going to unite us, or one definition of what it means to be American, or one definition of what it means to be a decent human being. And also just, you know, how we move in this space, whether it's, you know, Arizona, Phoenix, or the United States, our place in this society shouldn't be based on, like, whether or not you belong. It should really just be based on who you are, what you believe, and having confidence that that is enough to be a, you know, someone who contributes to society and maybe even make it a better place.
All right, Chris Ferrer Phillips, thanks so much for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up on this Halloween, a local haunted house designed to drive you mad.
Isn't that such a wonderful name? Oh, it's my most favorite name of all time. It makes you faster, stronger, and smarter than ever before. Everyone deserves Aurora.
We'll hear from the creator of The Mill of Madness.
But first, you might have heard of greenwashing around environmental issues or pinkwashing around Breast Cancer Awareness Month. But we're going to spend the next few minutes talking about Latino coding.
Once a year, you know, companies do their Hispanic Heritage Month effort, whatever that looks like. You know, maybe they change their logo and add a little green and red, you know, accents to it, or they do their little employee resource group driven initiative, and then they don't do anything the rest of the year. That is the classic Latino coding effort.
That's Jose Villa, chair of the Hispanic Marketing Council. He's been in Latino-focused marketing for nearly three decades, and his organization spearheaded a campaign to get companies to stop Latino coding and think more critically about how to market to this growing demographic. I spoke with him more about Latino coding and the opportunity lost in it and how he thinks the presidential campaigns are doing in their Latino marketing.
It's translations, awkward adaptations of campaigns. It's casting the Latina, you know, the Hispanic woman in the mixed race family on your commercial, right? You know, with 2.5 kids as opposed to 1.5 kids.
Right.
You know, it's the running your ad on Spanish TV in English, you know, during a soccer game. So there's a bunch of different examples, but there, you know, the overarching sort of issue is just it's not a well thought out. It's a haphazard and in some ways like token approach to the Hispanic market.
Yeah, token is a good word for it.
Mm-hmm.
What has the effort looked like to change this from your point of view? Like, are there companies that get this and are doing this better now? And what does that look like?
Well, absolutely. There are definitely companies that are doing things right, have been consistently doing that for many, many years. And it tends to be focused in certain industries. There's certain industries that have for many, many years been focused on the Hispanic market because a lot of their growth has come from it, you know, mm-hmm. And classic examples are like the big beer brands because they heavily sell to the Hispanic market. And it's a big part of their consumer base. And so they've always done a good job. It's kind of everybody else that we kind of have to like educate every once in a while because they forget, you know, and it's part of it is also just, you know, there's generations, you know, there's new marketers coming into positions of leadership in companies. And so you always, you know, they don't all know all this. So we have to constantly educate. And then the other thing is the Hispanic market's also changing all the time. So
yeah. You
know, the Hispanic market in 2024 looks very different than it did in 1984, let alone, you know, 2004. So that's also a big reason why we have to be doing this.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. So, okay, so we have to talk about what this looks like in the political landscape that we are in right now, because if anyone's talking about advertising at this particular moment, we are thinking immediately of the bombardment we are all experiencing of mm-hmm. political advertising right now. Both campaigns seem to understand that Latinos are going to be an incredibly important demographic in this election. How do you think they're doing? Are they taking the same approach, these two campaigns?
Well, they're taking different approaches, and I think they're both doing some things right, and then they're both kind of missing some opportunities as well. So in terms of the Harris campaign and the Democrats, they've got their Hombres for Kamala campaign. Mm-hmm. They're really focused on Hispanic men, and I think that's really smart. I think that's an example of doing the segmentation and the real sort of precision targeting that is the most effective in the Hispanic market. They understand that the Hispanic market is not a monolith. You know, 68 million Hispanics are not all the same. And they're really focusing on one particular subsegment, obviously a very big one, of primarily Mexican men. And that's, you know, that's super interesting because they know that's where they have the biggest problem,
right?
In terms of that's where they're bleeding support to the Republicans. And so they're really laser focused on that demographic. Now, you know, whether the policy and the messaging is right, that's kind of another issue, but they're, you know, they're laser focused on the right market. They understand some of the key insights that they have to hit on, and they're doing a really good job in that sense.
Right. Okay. So what about on the Trump side? I mean, he has made, at least as far as polling shows, some pretty big inroads with especially Latino men.
Yeah. He has. And I think that's just been driven by some of the issues that have resonated with Hispanic men. And I think what, you know, they're doing smart, you know, they've got their Latino Americanos or, you know, Latin Americans for Trump effort. And that's kind of the platform that they've been working under. And, you know, they're kind of taking a slightly different approach. It's in some ways, I think also smart in terms of even using that word Latino Americans for Trump. Mm-hmm. They're not, they're understanding that it is a diverse population. And they're seeing a lot of support from the non-Mexican segments of the market. That happened starting in 2020. They saw they were doing really well with Puerto Ricans. Obviously, Cubans are a very traditionally conservative group, and primarily in Florida, but also like Venezuelans, a lot of new immigrant groups that have come into the United States in the last, you know, 15, 20 years. And so they've kind of have a little bit of a almost a broader umbrella tent that they're using to reach Hispanics, and really like focusing in on the fact that they're not just focusing on Mexican Hispanics, but this broader sort of big tent of these other groups of in terms of country of origin that they're making sure that they're connecting to. Because, you know, that whole hyphen concept of, you know, most Hispanics identify with their country of origin. You know, they're Cuban American, they're Venezuelan American, and they're sort of tapping into that in the way that they're approaching the Hispanic market. And again, I think smartly.
So one of the things that comes to mind when you're talking about the idea of Latino coding and how brands do this kind of ineffectively is that it's a big missed opportunity. It sounds like you think both of these political campaigns are doing a pretty good job not missing that opportunity, finding the demographics that matter here and trying to reach them. Are they hitting all those marks, though? Where are the missed opportunities for them?
One of the missed opportunities, I would say, particularly on the, I think on the Democrat side, is missing the importance of the Hispanic population in some of the swing states that you don't traditionally consider to be swing states, to be Hispanic markets. So, you know, some of those markets up in the upper Midwest, you know, the Michigans, the Pennsylvanias, and even in the South, in North Dakota, not putting in as much of an effort to reach those groups, because there are a lot of Hispanics in those markets. And, you know, they could represent the difference in the election. You know, on the Trump side, I know they have an overall strategy of sort of outsourcing a lot of their outreach and on the ground activity to third party groups. And I know this election cycle, they're not doing a ton of Hispanic targeted advertising coming directly from the campaign. So it's a missed opportunity in the sense that, you know, they're not putting their resources. They have a lot less money than the other side, but they're still, you know, I think a missed opportunity there in terms of investing some of their precious dollars into this market, which they could activate very effectively in all seven of the swing states.
All right. We'll leave it there for now. Jose Villa, president of Census, chair of the Hispanic Marketing Council, joining us to talk more about Latino coding and how this is looking in the 2024 presidential campaign. Jose, thank you for coming on. Thanks for taking the time. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Recently on the show, we told you about research that shows reservoirs across the country are facing lower levels and that their storage is becoming less reliable. New reporting from the Rio Grande Valley in Texas finds a pair of reservoirs in that region are facing similar problems. In this case, though, it appears to be a binational problem, with both the U.S. and Mexico sharing in the blame. Berenice Garcia is the Rio Grande Valley reporter for the Texas Tribune and joins me to talk about what she's found. And Berenice, what is the current situation with reservoirs in your part of the world?
So the reservoirs that feed into the Rio Grande River, or the Rio Grande, that supply water to the Rio Grande Valley region here, they're the Amistad reservoirs and the Falcon reservoirs. And right now they're still at pretty low levels. They're not at the record levels that they had reached back in June, but they're still pretty low. The Amistad Reservoir is at 21% capacity, while the Falcon Reservoir is at 12%. And so what that has meant for communities down here is they are, you know, they still are in water use restrictions. Cities across the valley have issued those restrictions on residents, which basically will tell them to, you know, not to irrigate their lawns on certain days and things like that.
Is this a surprise that the reservoirs are where they are right now?
It's not a big surprise, mainly because this has been an issue for several years. The Mexican government has been unable to really fulfill their duties under the 1944 treaty, in which they are supposed to release some of the water that they have into the reservoirs. So it's been an ongoing issue. I think people have seen this coming for many years, and they've been trying to get Mexico to sort of catch up with the water that they owe. And it's been difficult because Mexico is also dealing with the same drought conditions. You know, the drought doesn't end at the border.
Yeah, what have those conversations been like between maybe U.S. or Texas officials and those in Mexico about trying to get Mexico to fulfill its obligations here?
They had been ongoing for several months. They had been trying to negotiate what's called a minute, which is an amendment to the 1944 treaty. And so we've had congressional leaders, a congressman I know who represents the Rio Grande Valley. He's met with leaders at the highest levels of the Mexican government, and they've assured that they are going to make that amendment official. As the treaty is sort of worded now, Mexico is supposed to deliver a certain amount of water within a 5-year period, but the way that they want to change it would set more accountability, and they would ha it would change it so that Mexico would be meeting those requirements every single year.
But if Mexico doesn't necessarily have the water to send, what are the other options?
Yeah, that's a good question. I know that the IBWC, they've been really pointing out the fact that the Rio Grande Valley, unfortunately, is too dependent on the Rio Grande. And it's very important, and what they're trying to do is stress that it's very important to find other alternatives. So what you have here in the region is water supply corporations looking to other sources such as groundwater. They're looking at the aquifers.
Is some of the shortage here also because of water that should have been deposited into these reservoirs from American sources? Is it all just Mexico's fault, or are there some American sources that are a little short here as well?
So yeah, that's a great point. It isn't just the water that Mexico owes the US that's sort of been dwindling. It's also water from the American tributaries, I suppose, or the inflows from the US that are supposed to go into the Amasad Reservoir and the Falcon Reservoir that have been decreasing over time.
Yeah, that's an interesting point because I wonder how much has to happen or what has to happen for these reservoirs to get back to a place where maybe people aren't super worried about them anymore.
Yeah, it would take much more than just Mexico complying with the treaty. You know, it goes back to the need to diversify their sources of water. I was speaking to a meteorologist earlier this year, when farmers in the valley were really, really looking for rain and hoping that, a storm or even a hurricane would be able to provide the water that was really necessary for their dwindling crops. Fortunately or unfortunately, we really didn't get a big rain event this summer, which is great for most of the residents who don't want to have to deal with flooding and the dangers that come with that. But as for people in the agriculture business, it was really disappointing because it was their last hope, at least for this year, when it came to having any sort of water for their crops. So that being said, when I was talking to that meteorologist, he mentioned that if we, in order for the reservoirs to really build back up, it would require a massive hurricane that dropped like 50 inches of rain. And it would just be a really major and devastating weather event like that. It just takes a lot of work from local communities here, from the local water supply corporations to really invest in, again, in alternative water supplies like groundwater instead of the surface water from the river.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that because you'd mentioned the idea of diversifying the water supply. Are there other sources that are available to these communities?
Yeah, certainly. So there are a few water supply corporations that have already invested in wells that are getting water from the ground and using desalinization to treat the water, and have that as the supply for that community. So they're still at a situation where most of the water they do receive and they do treat comes from the surface water from the river, but they're hoping to change that.
All right. That is Berenice Garcia, the Rio Grande Valley reporter with the Texas Tribune. Berenice, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Today is, of course, Halloween. And here at the show, we wondered, if you were a ghost, where is it that you might hang out in the afterlife? For one early trailblazer of Phoenix, long deceased, that answer may be the Arizona Historical Society in Tempe. The show producer, Sativa Peterson, caught up with Katie Forgia, executive assistant at the Arizona Historical Society, to see if they could confirm a spooky rumor. Is it true that a couple of spirits like to visit?
Yeah, I can kind of confirm that we do have some spooky things happen here on occasion. Several spirits do float in and out, but there are two in particular that hang out all the time.
I'm intrigued. Who is the first spirit?
One of them we know for sure is Hattie Mosier. Very eccentric, wealthy woman, was kind of a maker shaker here in the state of Arizona.
What do we know about her?
She's so much fun. She came here with her father in the early 1870s. Her father's name is Samuel Lount. Most people might know that from the early ice machines. He was actually a Canadian and came down with his ice machine. The ice house downtown that's still standing was his. Hattie came down with him and their family in the early 1870s.
So a Canadian man dealing with ice, gonna make a go of it here in the desert. It kind of shows a really adventurous character, I would say.
Right. Absolutely. And I believe Hattie inherited some of that adventure seeking from her father. His ice wagon in Phoenix was known around the town. There was actually a polar bear painted on the side by Hattie. That eventually became their logo. Further along in Hattie's life, she did end up marrying a man named Charles Mosier. He was one of the first editors of the Arizona Republic. She did also work at the Arizona Republic as a journalist, and they did have a little girl, Julia. Hattie adored Julia. That was her whole life. Sadly, the relationship with Mr. Mosier did not last. They did divorce. And upon that divorce, Julia and Hattie went to Europe and traveled around Europe for 12 years. So again, a very adventurous lifestyle.
During Hattie's time abroad, she worked as a newspaper woman. But when her father died in 1901, Hattie and her beloved daughter Julia returned to Arizona. Hattie inherited about 10 acres of land from her wealthy father in downtown Phoenix.
She, in turn, then tried to build a bridal shop, a tea house, and a hotel on approximately Central Avenue and Van Buren.
Wow, very adventurous, especially in that time, for a woman to endeavor to create those different businesses.
Absolutely. One of my favorite little facts about Hattie is she's known to be the first woman to ride a bike in Arizona. We actually have a photo of that back in our collections.
Okay, very important question here. How does Hattie Mosier make herself known here at the Historical Society? You know, how is it that you and other staff here have come to know that this spirit you're encountering is that of Hattie Mosier?
We have her daughter, Julia's diaries from when she was very young and into some of her older life and in various family heirlooms. During Julia's second childbirth, she sadly passed away. And from that point on, Hattie kind of was never really the same. And we just kind of think that she's here just because of her love for Julia and wanting to be near things that belonged to her. We can often smell roses, which was one of Hattie's favorite perfumes. We know that from Julia's diaries. And we know she's around just because we can kind of catch whiffs of that. And it's typically near Julia's diaries, too. So
in that part of the building where the diaries are kept, you might turn a corner and smell the scent of roses?
Yeah, that's right. And it's a beautiful smell.
And do we know what did Hattie look like when she was alive?
Hattie lived until 1945. When I encounter her, I often encounter her as a younger individual. So imagine somebody in the nicest Victorian era dress. Often she loved her fur, so she would have a little fur hat on. Her hair is dark and curly. She really liked the color blue. And that rose perfume is definitely her signature. Others, when they have described her to me, encounter her when she's slightly older, towards the end of her life. As I said, she did not take Julia's death during childbirth very well, and became a little bit more eccentric in her older life. Even in 1945, she went back to wearing some of those Victorian era clothing. I mean, big hats with feathers and boas and different things like that. But she'd be caught riding a bike with 1945 sneakers on.
Is there a particular place or areas in the building that Hattie likes to make herself known?
She really likes to hang out in library and archives. One, because Julia's diaries are there, but she also has an attachment to one of her hat racks. Like I was saying, she would wear these big, huge, feather-covered, fur-covered hats, and we think she likes to hang her hats on this particular hat rack. Occasionally, we'll need to move it for doing different things around the museum. When we do that, we notice electronics don't really work the same. Our pencils might go missing, our sharpeners go missing, our staplers, our printer doesn't work until we place that hat rack back where it belongs. So we like to attribute that to Hattie letting us know that she can't get to her hats.
That was Katie Forgia of the Arizona Historical Society. The real Hattie Mosher was a woman of many adventures and many losses. Despite her trailblazing spirit, her projects didn't always go as planned. Hattie's Tea House was a three-story structure. Construction was never completed, and the bottom floor lacked finished walls. And her hotel, started in 1923, also lay vacant and unfinished for years. It was commonly referred to by residents of Phoenix as Mosher's Folly. She also ran unsuccessfully for Arizona State Senate and Phoenix City Commissioner. Towards the end of her life, Hattie was quite destitute and could be seen around Phoenix wearing tattered clothes that had once been quite elegant. But if you visit the Arizona Historical Society and find yourself in a part of the building where her daughter's diaries are kept, you just might turn a corner and smell the scent of roses. For KJZZ's The Show, I'm Sativa Peterson.
If you'd like to read Julia Mosher's diaries, you can make an appointment with the Arizona Historical Society at arizonahistoricalsociety.org. There is one other frequent ghost who likes to appear there, Lewis C. Hill, an engineer involved with the construction of the Roosevelt Dam. He can sometimes be spotted still working at his drafting table. Good morning. It is The Show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. For many Americans, it's a scary time, and not just because it's Halloween. But as the show's Sam Dingman recently discovered, sometimes a good scare isn't such a bad thing.
On a recent Sunday evening, I drove out to an eerily empty office park to participate in a medical experiment. When I got to the door of the clinic, I was greeted by a very enthusiastic nurse who told me that I was about to be dosed with a powerful drug called Aurora.
Isn't that such a wonderful name? Oh, it's my most favorite name of all time. It makes you faster, stronger, and smarter than ever before. Everyone deserves Aurora, no matter the age.
The nurse's energy was unnerving. But before I could change my mind and leave, I found myself being ushered through the door of a tent with some other patients. Right away, we could tell something wasn't right. We were surrounded by tables strewn with disembodied limbs. We could hear dissonant sounds and muffled screams behind the hallway walls. And then, out of nowhere, these wild-haired figures in surgical gowns started jumping out at us.
Whoa! Okay.
After that, my sense of reality began to disintegrate. A woman in a bone mask appeared, urging us to be calm as our souls left our bodies.
Oh, it's all part of the process, baby! You know where you're headed, right?
Before long, I was face to face with a demon. Fear not, dear listener. I successfully escaped this hellmouth. I'd love to tell you it was thanks to my courage or bravery, but the actual reason is that none of it was real. The whole thing was an immersive live horror experience called The Mill of Madness. It's a style of performance that creator Ryan Barney refers to as a haunt. I invited Barney to the studio to tell me about the process of pulling off an effective scare, which starts, he says, with casting.
The guys that I find, a lot of them are theater students in the colleges. Some are just veteran haunters, friends, family, people who just love to scare people.
Tell me a little bit about that. I'm really fascinated by that formulation you just used, people who love to scare people. What does that kind of person mean to you? Because I could imagine somebody hearing that and imagining like their annoying uncle from when they were a kid who's always like jumping out from behind something and terrifying them or something like that.
That's me. Okay. That's you. So I look for somebody who's like me. So my staff will tell you, if I hear that somebody's in the bathroom, I put my phone on silent. I creep down low because there's certain ways to do it, right? I'm a tall, big guy. So I come right up the doorknob. They open the doorknob of the bathroom. I jump out and so I scare them every time. Every single time. They even know it's coming and I scare them every time. So those are the kind. I look for somebody just like me who just really gets joy out of seeing everybody scream. And a short story, my sister came in. She also works with me. She's on the production staff. She came in on a Saturday and she was doing some extra work. So no one was supposed to be there. And I happened to have the security camera still on so I could see that it was only her. She was in a certain area. So I came in, opened the door, and I made just a little bit of noise for her to go ahead and see if anybody had come in. And I had threw a magazine on the ground, and she heard that. And then I came around the corner. I have it on video because the security cams are there. It is the best scare that I have had. And
oh,
she's like, there was a slight bit of crying, you know, there in, as before she got composed.
So what do you like about doing that? What brings you joy about that?
That's a really good question. I think it's the laughter afterward.
Mm.
You know, it's the shock, but then knowing that it's okay. I've always liked that, you know, get your heart pumping. Nobody's hurt. Nobody's, you know, there's no real issue. But I don't know, it just brings joy to see people, you know, get entertained. And then most of the time, you know, very rarely do I have somebody who's like angry with me afterward.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's a little moment to like laugh and say, man, you got me again.
You know, as you were telling that story about your sister, I thought about this experience I had in college where my two friends who lived across the hall, these are some of my closest friends, they snuck into, I had a single dorm room, and they snuck into my closet, unbeknownst to me, they snuck into my closet and they hid, and they waited until I turned the lights out and climbed into bed.
Love it.
And then they waited, and then they opened the door and said, "Good night, Sam." And I shrieked, but like in the moment of shrieking, I was like, oh, that's Mac. That's Mac's voice. I know Mac's voice. And to your point, I don't even know why I did it because I was so furious at him. I laughed so hard afterwards. And there was something about it that was like, it was so funny because I thought I was in so much danger and actually I was so safe.
Right.
Because he never would do anything to hurt me.
Of course.
I'm just realizing this in real time as you're talking about this.
I think a lot of it is the control dynamic too,
mm-hmm.
right? As I'm scaring you, I'm in control.
Yeah.
But I'm not in control in an awkward way.
Right.
And then you're submitting to that control for that moment.
Right.
And then we're regaining it in a safe way that makes it kind of fun.
Right. And of course, somebody is choosing to have this experience, right?
Right?
So I'm, by coming to one of your experiences, I'm handing you the keys to my
Correct.
Trust. What do you think it is about people that we want this kind of experience, as distinct from, say, you know, there's been a lot of discussion about why people like horror movies, but this is different, you know, because you're really there. You're really in the space. Even though, as we were just saying, you know you're safe, you are really exposing yourself to something happening in your physical proximity. What do you think draws people to that?
I think that people are looking for something more real. And that may seem kind of odd considering it's a haunt and everything is fake, right?
Sure.
But it's a real experience. We have Hollywood spending millions of dollars on films that some of them are not doing very well. And I think because visually we're looking for something more. We know that it was all done on a computer and it doesn't get to us. And I think that people are drawn to this that want a real experience and to have that real adrenaline rush, still knowing they're going to be safe.
Mm-hmm.
The feelings are real, and I think that's what they're looking for.
Yeah. So as a storyteller, how do you think about generating feeling when you're building and designing the story?
I think it's the emotional ups and downs.
Mm.
So I don't want it just to be scary or jump the entire way. I want you to feel a little uncomfortable here. Then I want you to feel scared here. I want you to feel panic. And then I want to give you relief. And so our first, I guess you could call it act, it ends very, very intense, as in there's a special effects show with waterworks and geysers, and there's zombies kind of surrounding you, and you feel like this utter panic, and then you're saved by somebody, and then it calms down some. And then it will build again, and then you start to lose your mind. So my style is to have you go through that emotional roller coaster, and that is what keeps you, you know, is it going to be scary? Is it going to be emotional? Is it, you know, what is going to happen? And that ups and downs, I think, is what makes it strong.
You know, it just occurred to me, you were talking about the appeal of something like this being, we can tell when something's not real and we want to have an experience that's real. But the life experience that you're simulating in this is people losing their grip on reality.
Right.
And that seems like kind of a core in your formulation or framing. That seems like kind of a core anxiety that people are walking around with. It's like, is this real? Like, is this actually happening?
Well, you lost your control, right? And I think that's everybody's biggest fear is losing control.
Mm-hmm.
And losing control of your mind, what's scarier than that?
Yeah.
And so you're voluntarily giving up that control to have that experience. And I think that's what works.
All right. Ryan Barney, creator of Mill of Madness, currently running the Aurora experiment. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And that'll do it for this Thursday edition of the show. Lauren, what's your favorite kind of candy?
Ooh, Twix, maybe?
Twix, okay.
I like a good caramel, you know, thrown in there.
Okay, yeah. Everyone likes a Twix? Sounds good. So if you see Lauren trick-or-treating with her kids tonight, make sure to hand out the Twix.
I'll take one, yeah.
All right. Thanks so much for listening. For Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody. Have a terrific rest of your day. Have a happy and safe Halloween tonight. Hope to have you right back here off your sugar rush tomorrow.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.